Welcome to Women Leading the Way radio show, where each time you'll hear from successful women CEOs, executives, and professionals, where we'll discover how they do what they do to be successful in business. We'll be interviewing women who have overcome big challenges, women who have incredible stories of lessons learned in dealing with adversity. We'll even interview women who have started and grown successful organizations, and women who are C-level executives with unique talents and positions. Our goal is to bring successful businesswomen together to share how they're leading the way in business today.
Good afternoon, listeners. This is John Burroughs with Skyline Home Loans in Philly, the Finance of America, and I will be your host this afternoon on Women Lead Radio Show, along with my partner and associate, Rebecca Ross. Rebecca, please say hello to all the listeners, if you would.
Hi, everyone. This is Rebecca Ross. I am with Skyline, and I oversee the Maui operation, and I've been originating in California and Hawaii for the last 25 years.
So Rebecca and I are partners with Corporate Part V Connected Women of Influence, and we are at your corporate sponsor level, and we're here to make our first debut with the Connected Women of Influence Women Lead Radio Show, and we, in fact, as the introduction implies, have a guest with us today, one Lori Bolander, Esquire, attorney. And Lori is an accomplished attorney that I have known for quite some time now with Gallagher Bolander and Smedley, LLP. And we'd just like to welcome Lori to the show.
Welcome. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, we have a show we're calling right now, Your Financial Fitness. And what we decided with our ideas to put together over the next 12 months of 2019 is that every single month bring somebody with an area of expertise that centers around a family's fiscal health and their financial fitness. And one of the most important parts of that puzzle, since we are in the mortgage banking industry and real estate and finance for, combined, I think, between the two of us, Rebecca, you and I have, what, about 65 years experience, something like that?
Something crazy.
Something crazy like that. So why we wanted Lori to come on is because as an attorney specializing in estate planning and all things relative to that, that's part of your family's fitness. So, Lori, if you would, please, for our listeners, just kind of give us a little bit of a background about yourself. Feel free to toot your own horn here.
Okay, I will do that. So I've been an attorney for about 14 years, and I worked for an estate planning attorney while I was in college and law school. So I actually have, you know, another 5 years on top of that where I was actually working in this industry, drafting documents, meeting with clients, and all of that. And so my main focus, as you said, is estate planning and all things related to that, including probates and administering trusts and representing trustees and beneficiaries, and doing things in the probate court like conservatorships and guardianships when they arise. I also do adoptions, which is a little niche area that I have. I am adopted, and so it's something I enjoy doing. And sometimes it works together well with the estate planning for various reasons. And so I just joined Gallagher Bolander Smedley, and this firm has been around the Point Loma, Ocean Beach area for 70 years throughout the different partners changing through and also providing estate planning and trust administration work to all the residents here.
That's quite a track record. There's some over 70 years there, so
yeah.
Obviously well-established too. And something drove you to that firm. I believe we had a conversation last week about that. What was so attractive that made you come to this firm in particular?
I'd actually known my partners for 18 years. I actually shared office space with them when I was working for the attorney in college and law school. And it's just a great opportunity to focus a little bit more on the planning side of things and stay away from court a little bit more. I still do court work, but I can do a little bit less of it and spend more time with my four-year-old son.
There you go. And Rebecca, please, I don't want to dominate all the questions, but as we move along, if something pops into your head, by all means, ask Lori. But Lori, just in general, tell me, define an estate plan folks hear those words all the time, but they may not really understand what is that all about.
Yeah, exactly. So when we're doing an estate plan for somebody, generally, it depends a little bit on their situation, but generally what we're setting up for them is a trust and a pour-over will and a health care directive and a power of attorney, and then assisting them on making sure their assets are actually titled in the name of their trust. And, you know, whether somebody not everybody needs a trust, but if you've got assets, and in California, our probate limit is $150,000. So if you have assets that equal $150,000, it's advisable to have a trust to avoid the probate court. And then for real estate, it's $50,000. So basically, if you own property, you need a trust. And probate's also one of those words that people hear all the time, and they know they don't want to do it, but they're not really sure exactly what it is. And really what probate is the process, the legal process of taking assets out of your name when you die. So it is a court procedure that is initiated by somebody, a family member, to transfer all the assets out of your name. And it's there to make sure that they go to the proper people so that somebody just doesn't come in and take a decedent's assets and distribute them to themselves. But it's a very long, complicated procedure.
I'm going to back up a little bit if I can, Lori. Yeah, I want to back up a little because just like in our industry, Rebecca and I both know, we would just assume people know what we're talking about, but we have our own funny little vernacular in the real estate finance business. But you said two terms that I'd like you to define a little more specifically. You said early on the pour-over will. Part of establishing the trust, you're doing a pour-over will. How is that different, or what specifically is that from just the word, I've got a will?
Right, and that's one of the things that people get confused about in general. You know, when you think about somebody dying, you think about what does their will say? And in fact, even when there is a trust, people say that. So when you have a will, like, never mind the pour-over for a minute, I'll get to that. But when you have a will, what it is it's a legal document that says when I die, this is how I want my assets distributed, and this is who I want them to be in charge of distributing them. That's your executor. And but it does not avoid the actual probate process because your assets are still in your name. So what happens if you have a will is it gets submitted to probate court, and the court will follow the terms of your will. They'll appoint the person that you've nominated to be the executor, and they'll make sure it's distributed pursuant to your wishes. But, of course, we want to avoid the probate court, so we go into, you know, the trust realm. And how the trust actually avoids probate is by taking assets out of your name. So when you die, you don't have any assets in your name. They're all titled in the trust. And the trust says that, you know, my son or daughter or sister or brother is going to be the trustee, and they're going to distribute it this way. And so they can just step in and start administering your trust. Now, when you have a trust, you still need a will. You need the will as a backfall. So it's largely inoperative when you have a trust because all your assets are in your trust. But if there's something that's outside of it, your attorney didn't know about it, for example, and it didn't get titled into your trust, the will is there to pour all of your assets into your trust, hence the name the pour-over will. It's there to pour everything in. It also serves to pour all of your personal property into the trust because we can't retitle your TV or your couch into the name of your trust. And so what happens is when you die, it all gets poured into your trust. So that's your pour-over will. So not everybody needs a trust, but everybody needs a will.
And what happens if you don't have a will?
If you don't have a will, there's always a misconception that everything goes to the state, and that's not true. But it will go to probate, so you will have to have a probate court administer your estate or your executor through the probate court. And so if you don't have a will, you don't have anything to give the judge to say this is how Lori wanted her estate distributed. So there's California laws that set up what's called intestacy statutes saying who gets your property. And generally speaking, it's, you know, your spouse and your children. And then if you don't have those, then it goes back up to your parents. And if you don't have, if they're not around anymore, it goes down to your siblings. If you have no siblings, then we go back up to grandparents' generation and then come down with aunts and uncles and cousins and whatnot. So the very, you know, and it gets all the way down to next of kin. So if you have none of these people, and I've encountered this situation, it actually ended up in a situation where we had 120 heirs in the probate because we went to next of kin. So then it'll go to next of kin, and then it will even go to like a predeceased spouse's children before it will sheet to the state.
So,
my goodness.
Aside from it being what sounding very cumbersome with having to go through this probate procedure, is there an expense involved?
Oh, yes, yeah. So that is one of the biggest deterrents for probate for people. So the attorney's fees and the executor's fees are statutory, meaning they're set by law for probate. And it's this real funky calculation, and it's a percentage of the assets. It starts with 4% of the first 100,000, and then 3% of the next 100,000, and then 2% of the next 800,000, and then 1% of the next 2.5 million. And then after that, it's in the judge's discretion, really. You're really not getting out of probate for in any size estate for under $10,000. In that equation. And then you have to consider that that's not just the attorney's fee, but the executor gets the same exact fee. Double that. And then you have, of course, all your costs. So you've got your filing fees, and you've got your probate referee, which is an appraiser appointed by the court to appraise all the assets. So you've got their fees, and then just little, you know, things about getting certified letters, and you may have to be bonded. The court may require you to get a bond, and that sometimes can be an issue because every now and then we get families where none of the kids are bondable. They all got bad credit. So then we end up with a third party administering your estate that doesn't even know you. So
for the investment,
that could be a little cumbersome.
Yes.
So it sounds like the investment into setting up your trust ahead of time is money well spent.
Absolutely. I mean, generally, a married couple can set up a trust for, you know, I would say on an average, you know, fees are going to be about $2,500 to set up, you know, your full estate plan. And for a single person, maybe, you know, around $1,500. And so that is, you know, pales in comparison to the cost of the probate. And probate takes a really long time, too. You know, we only have 3 probate judges in the county of San Diego. And so when we, you know, file a petition, it's months before it's heard. So, you know, if somebody dies, you call the attorney and say, oh, we have to file a probate. You get all the information to them. So that's probably a month right there. And then you finally file your petition, and then it's set for 2 months from then. So nobody's even appointed until you get to that first hearing. And the same thing happens when you go to close the estate. You know, you do everything you need to do to administer the estate. Okay, we're ready to close. You file your petition, and then you wait 3 months to get it heard.
So I have a question.
I have a question for you. Go ahead, Rebecca. You first.
Okay. Thanks, John. Life insurance, you have a beneficiary.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a trust.
Mm-hmm.
Does that go through a probate?
It does not. So anything with a beneficiary designation will not be a probate asset. However, what happens is people name their minor children, oh, my 10-year-old son's my beneficiary on my life insurance. Now, that won't go through probate, but now if you die and he's still 10, he needs a guardianship. The company will not release money to a minor. A bank will not release money to a minor. Minors legally cannot inherit. So, and this is where my guardianship practice comes in, because this happens, and then we need to go to court and have a guardian appointed for the child. And sometimes those can be the messiest thing, because there's the issue of who's he going to live with, which is a guardianship of the person, and then there's the issue of who's going to handle his money, and that's a guardianship of the estate. And that can be a real emotional thing for the family, and you've got money added into it too, which always complicates, you know, familial relationships.
Yes.
So.
Understood.
So, and the other thing that I see a lot with beneficiary designations is mom and dad were married for 60 years. Dad died in, you know, 2000. Mom lived for another 20 years. and she never took them off as the primary beneficiary, and she has no contingent beneficiaries. Now you're going to probate.
Got it.
So when I have people come in, I say this is a really great time to look at all your beneficiary designations and make sure they're all up to date and in order and all that. So, and, you know, of course, I always offer to help them do that so that I make sure that it gets done. Because the worst thing is to have a client come in and pay to do the full estate plan. We get everything titled in the trust, and then, oh, whoops, I never did anything with that life insurance policy, and now I have no designated beneficiary, and it has to go to probate.
Wow. Well, I have a question here, and in both of you being mothers, I know this will be of certain interest for you, specific to the children, backtracking to that. Please explain that importance of that, you know, the guardianship, because I was thinking about this recently with a client, and they said they really didn't have anybody within their family, in their immediate siblings, that they felt were appropriate or responsible enough to be able to handle that. So I'm sure you've run across this before. What do you do when you cannot find either an appropriate successor trustee or a guardian for your children? How do you handle that dilemma?
Right. So I mentioned earlier that, you know, all the children aren't bondable, then you end up with a third party. Well, there are actually people that will serve as trustees and executors and guardians as their profession. That's what they do. They're licensed through the state of California. They're bonded. They're, yeah, most of them, I presume, are insured. And so these people can serve to distribute your estate or hold the money for the kids over the, you know, their minority. And a lot of times, quite frankly, it's a good choice because you don't have the emotions and the hierarchy in the family. And if you have, I don't have any siblings, but I know this from my work. There's a hierarchy in the family, you know. People are, you know, I'm closest to mom and I should be the one that does this, or I'm the financial advisor, I should be the one that does this. And it's a power play within the family. And so when you have that third party coming in and, you know, they know what they're doing, they do it all the time, they're not emotional about this, they have a job to do, so they come in, they marshal all the assets, that means collect all the assets, look at the trust and say, oh, you know, pay the taxes and do whatever needs to be done, and then they distribute it out to the kids, and it's done. Where sometimes you get family members, and, you know, then there's squabbling, and, you know, there's some trustees that are, you know, I'm the trustee, I can do anything I want, I have all the power. And what I always tell my trustee clients is you do have all the power. You have a lot of powers under these documents. In fact, the trustees have the same ownership, basically, than that the trustor did, that the deceased person did. They have all the powers. They can sell property. They can rent property. They can invest. They can sell stocks. They can, you know, transact business. They can do all sorts of things. But what you have to remember when you're a trustee is that you also have vast duties to the beneficiaries. Your job wouldn't exist. You wouldn't have any powers if you didn't have these duties to these beneficiaries. And so it's, you know, you've got to keep your beneficiaries informed and do everything that's in their interest. So, again, when you've got a third party trustee, they're called private fiduciaries. When you have a private fiduciary, they know their job. They're not emotionally invested. There's no hierarchy. They are going to come in and distribute the estate. So, and when they're
started,
go ahead.
I have a word that came up, recently. And I'd like you to explain for people, because I still think that, you know, a judge being a reasonable person is always going to be looking to do the best for, you know, the individuals involved, whether it be probate or handling the trust. But when an error occurs, like something was just left out, and it's obvious that it was an inadvertent mistake when setting up or writing the will or setting the trust up, there's a do-over clause, so to speak, and I've heard this word, a Hegestead petition? Does that sound right?
Hegestead,
and
yes.
Could you explain, Hegestead petition, so when somebody makes a mistake, it's not the end of the world. There's a way to rectify that, correct?
Right. And a lot of times where we see this are when a lender's been involved. So what happens is, you know, my client comes in, does their trust, I deed their property over to their trust, and then 10 years later, they refinance the property, and the lender didn't put it back in the trust, because they make you take it out of the trust to do the refinance, and now the lenders are real good. They almost always are putting it back in, but for a long time there, they were not. And so a lot of the first Hegstead petitions were because of that exact situation. And what Hegstead is a case, the estate of Hegstead, where they intend, it was a similar situation where they intended it to be in the trust, but it wasn't in the trust when the person died. So like I was saying, you know, my client refinances their property, it's not in their trust. But in their trust, I have their schedule of assets and it has the house. So we go into court and say, look, Your Honor, they meant this to be in their trust. In fact, they even transferred it to their trust, but then they refinanced and inadvertently it got left out. And the intent of the trustor was that it go through the trust. And they give you an order saying, yep, it's a trust asset. You record it and it's back in the trust.
Good.
So
I have seen that in the past. Well, the good news now in our world, and Rebecca will concur, I'm sure, that now – with lending, they've got quite a bit more realistic about that entire process.
Right.
And we're doing the loans for people in their trust as long as we get a trust
right.
certification. So that has changed to the better.
Great, great. Yeah, that
Absolutely.
Is wonderful. And, you know, I don't know what it was. I had heard some lenders say, we don't want any liability, you know, associated with the trust. We don't want it to be in the trust when we do this. And it was like, well, but you're incurring more liability by taking it out of people's trust, you know. So, and I would always say to my clients, I say, make sure they put that your property back in the trust after the refinance. And if they don't, tell them that they need to knock, you know, a couple hundred bucks off their fees because that's what, you know, you're going to have to pay to do a new deed.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Rebecca, you have some additional questions for Lori?
You know, I think that there's a misnomer. You know, there's so much. I think it's 10 million before you have estate taxes. So a lot of people, I think, are under this assumption that if they're underneath 10 million, that they don't need all of these things. But you
yeah.
did explain that the thresholds are much, much lower.
Yeah. So. Exactly. So a probate can be triggered at $150,000 or $50,000
okay.
in real estate, right? But there's also
yes.
this misconception that everybody's affected by the estate tax, and that's just not the case. You know, you do have an over $10 million exemption. A married couple together is over $20 million. So you don't pay any estate tax. But, you know, the probate process and the estate tax are two totally separate things.
Right.
Exactly. Now, it's like anybody, everybody loves a good story. So have you run across anything that's a little bit outside the box? Because I know I have. I deal with a number of estate planning attorneys in the lending aspect and deal with a lot of inherited properties. But anything
yeah, I
that's
mean,
just completely outside the box?
I've seen all kinds of interesting things. I tell you, people... and even other attorneys kind of sometimes think, oh, estate planning, that's boring. I can tell you it is not. We see so many interesting things. I mean, families fighting and just even the decedent and sometimes their strange life or belongings or interesting life. You know, that's one thing I love about my job. When I'm meeting with my clients or if I'm administering somebody's estates, I get to hear their story and see what kind of person they were and the things that they did or, you know, artists. And, you know, I had a client that was a painter and he was amazing, but you know what he painted his whole life to make a living was the cover of those like graphic sex novels. And and well, and then he got in a whole situation where somebody was taking advantage of him and selling his paintings and taking his money. And so it was a very interesting situation. But, you know, it's just so interesting to see people. And, you know, there's a huge level of, like, sociology and psychology that I see with human interactions and family interactions and how people deal with death. It's It's interesting, you know, and how people deal with money and relate to money and all of these things kind of play into everything that I do. And you always have to kind of feel out the situation and feel out the people to see exactly the best way to proceed sometimes with how you administer the estate.
So you have a minor in psychology?
What's that?
I was just going to say that.
I said you have a minor in psychology.
Yeah, counselor at law.
Well, there you go. Well, for our listeners, if it was just to keep it even just simple, Lori, can you give us, if somebody's at a place where maybe they've just bought their first house, and I have a young couple in that situation now, they bought their first home and they have retirement accounts and a fair amount of savings, they've been responsible and they're in their mid-20s. Simple advice for somebody starting out square one, what's the first thing they're going to do? Obviously, making an appointment with somebody like yourself, but what are the first bits of advice of how do I plan this simple thing?
Yeah, and you know, some of the worst estates that I've seen as far as trying to clean things up are of younger people because they don't have a plan. And so, yeah, calling an attorney and saying, what's the process? How much is it going to cost? And the other misnomer for people is they go, oh, it's, you know, a big chunk of, you know, a few $1,000s to do this. I don't think I can do that. You know, I allow people to make payments over a few months. You know, you can work things out, but, you know, get it done. So the other thing you need to do is start having a conversation like this young couple, you know, start having a conversation with your spouse about who's going to be in control if both of us were to die and where are the kids going to live and where are we distributing our property? You know, because sometimes I have people and they're like, all right, we're finally going to do this. We're ready. And I'm like, okay, who's going to be your trustee? And they're like, oh, I don't know. You know? So it's like, I always tell them, I'm like, go home, open a bottle of wine and just start talking.
There you go. I have one other question relevant to this. Let's take it to the other end of the scale. I have a father who's 96 years old right now and is mentally totally together. However, that's not the case for everyone. At what point do the children or the successor trustees and the family look at mom or dad are starting to slip, and at some point they're not going to be in a position to be able to make these decisions? How do you deal with that scenario?
Yeah, absolutely, and that can be such a horrible situation, especially if you don't get the estate planning documents done, because then you end up at court in the conservatorship proceeding, and that's worse than probate, in my opinion. I mean, you're live, for one, and it can be much more expensive as well, and it's an ongoing procedure that lasts until a person dies. So, you know, and I know people often tell me, well, I don't want to talk to my mom about that. She's going to think I want her to die. And, you know, it's a difficult subject, but it's something you've got to approach, because if you're left in a situation where you've got no means to help your parent, you're going to end up in court and spending a whole bunch of money that doesn't need to be spent. You know, just sitting down and saying, you know, mom, I'm really concerned, you know, and I always like to try to put it in terms that are, could happen to anybody, but aren't necessarily going to happen to your parent. Like, you know, you could get, you know, in a car accident tomorrow, or you could fall, or, you know, and then what do we do? I don't know, you know, where's your bank account? And, you know, I need to know these things, and I'm not going to have any ability to do anything or help you, you know, if I don't have these documents. So that's a kind of a good way to approach it. I mean, you know, one of the really important documents, too, has nothing to do with money. It's your health care directive. You need somebody to make health care decisions for you if you can't. And that's just such a crucial document. And, again, that one, the absence of that document ends up in a conservatorship proceeding.
Not a good thing. So being planned is obviously the buzzword, thinking ahead a little bit. We've only got about roughly a minute left to our showtime. This just flew right by. So before I forget to do so, I just want to thank our leading lady today, Lori Bolander, for all the excellent advice that you've given us. And we want to tell all of our listeners out there, you know, thanks for listening. That's both in the U.S. and international, because we are an international show, and we'll be back with another episode of Women Lead Radio Show. Rebecca, you and I are going to be monthly co-hosts for this entire year, once a month on Fridays, so I'm looking forward to that. And our buzzword we came up with, and don't laugh at me, ladies, you know, your financial fitness, we just want to let you know, let us help you work out the details for your family's fiscal health. Any brilliant words of closing there, Rebecca, Lori?
No, I think you covered it all. Thanks for having me again, and I'm, you know, happy to be to share my knowledge of estate planning so more people get in line with that.
Thanks so much, Lori. Have a great weekend.
You too.
And I think
Women Leading the Way is produced by Connected Women of Influence, the premier private membership organization where like-focused business-to-business executive and professional women connect, collaborate, and cultivate a vast network of high-level affiliations, resources, and professional relationships. For more information about Connected Women of Influence, please visit our website at connectedwomenofinfluence.com.